Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and it is very slushy and snowy right here in Brooklyn. But actually, it's a pretty good time to set plans in motion for the growing season that's just around the corner. So that's why I'm talking with a couple experts on small-scale agriculture or microfarming, and the new book called Microfarming for Profit, From Garden to Glory, written by Dave DeWitt, who's on the line right now from New Mexico. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how's it going? I guess you're kind of cold there, right?
Yeah, it's been terrible, but actually today is oddly warm. I don't know. And then it's going to get cold again. So, yeah, we don't have it too well right now. But thanks so much for joining us. And,
sure.
You know, Dave, you've been a longtime food writer. You're also called the Pope of Peppers because you're passionate about growing chili peppers.
Yeah, they give me all kinds of titles like that, but I can handle it. It's okay.
Nice.
Whatever they want to call me.
So, no, that's so cool. You know, a food writer who also grows food is like, that just sounds really, really special. So thanks for writing this book, too. I want to also introduce another guest we have. It's Bea Ayer. She's right here in the station. Hi.
Well, good.
Hello.
Hi, good to meet you.
So Bea is a very experienced farmer. She's been a manager at numerous farming operations, including the youth farm at BK Farmyards right here in Brooklyn. So We're so excited to have you.
Good.
So this book, I got to say, this is such an excellent book. Both Bea and I have taken it around. At least I have, like, reading through it in the subway, just, you know, thinking wistfully about it being warmer out.
It won't be long.
Yeah.
Hang in there.
No, but this is also really cool because, you know, I seem to have a lot of other titles on, you know, gardening and farming. But this one is really up to date in describing all the ways that microfarming has manifested right now. So in particular, in your home state of New Mexico. So all these cool profiles of farmers and what they're doing, like yourself. But now, am I correct in thinking like New Mexico is maybe not the most likely state for agriculture?
You might think that because we're in the desert southwest and there's not a whole lot of water here. But, I mean, New Mexico has been under irrigation, you know, the acequias, the ditch system that we have from the rivers and so forth like that has been around since, you know, 400 years. We've been using the water that we have carefully to do this. And irrigation is a way of life. And fortunately, more and more farmers are switching from ditch irrigation to drip irrigation, which, of course, conserves a lot of water and is a very practical way. You have some initial expense in putting in drip systems. Once they're in place, you'll use far less water. And, of course, the farmers have to pay for water here because the rains are infrequent at best. And typically in New Mexico, we get between 8 and 12 inches of rain a year. And a lot of that comes during the summer monsoon season when we get a lot of storms coming up from Mexico and that sort of thing. So irrigation is the way to go in New Mexico. But we grow a surprising – I mean, we're the – I think fourth largest onion producer in the country.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, we're second in chili peppers. We used to be number one, but our acreage has dropped from nearly 30,000 acres to only about 8,000 acres in the past 20 years. Begin that's competition from Mexico mostly. We're usually number one or number two pecan producer. We fight with Georgia and Texas over pecans, But those aren't the kinds of crops that you can grow in a micro-farm.
Yeah. No.
I mean, one pecan trees, there's your micro-farm, you know.
Well, it looks like my assumptions were pretty off, but Bea actually has a lot of experience growing in unlikely places, such as abandoned lots in the city.
Yeah, it's surprising. There's actually quite a lot of land in New York City that is pretty good for growing.
It's just there.
Yeah, there's a lot of underutilized land, and then there's a lot of land that's temporarily not being used.
Mm-hmm. And rooftops, too, right?
Yeah, and there's rooftops, too. There's all sorts of things
there's
happening in New York City.
Above our heads right now in the place where we're sitting. So, yeah, people are discovering that.
Yeah, I think in New York City and a lot of cities, you know, around the world, they're really pushing, you know, the edge of what urban agriculture can be and actually how much you can produce in a small space.
Right.
It is amazing. It is amazing how much you can do. It's astounding to me that I grew 300 pounds of tomatoes 1 year in, I would say, no more than a couple of hundred square feet.
Well, that's,
I mean, it was just unbelievable.
It's a lot of tomatoes.
That's a lot of tomatoes, and that sounds great. So this book is about microfarming, and you draw the distinction of, you know, farming generally implies it's a business, it's for profit, whereas gardening is more like a hobby or perhaps just like a home, you know, vegetable plot. So tell us a little bit more about what inspired you to take the leap from gardening to microfarming.
Well, I've always had a garden, and I just decided to experiment and see whether or not I could create a garden that was a profitable little farm.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that I could, and the decision, of course, is whether or not I keep this up and keep doing it, or whether I write another book or something.
Because now I'm thinking that everybody who has about 300 square feet is thinking, well, maybe I can sell those tomatoes, 300 tons of tomatoes. Sorry, pounds. Tons? That would be another story. And so Bea, tell us a little bit about your operations, because you've worked in both sort of educational farms. But then I remember there was like a turn 1 year at the youth farm where you started producing products, value-added products with your
Right, right. And that's the key to having a profitable microfarm. You have to think beyond produce. And so many people just think of produce. Oh, here's some
tomatoes.
Carrots. I'll sell them at the farmer's market or something like that. When in reality, the profit from these things comes from value-added products that you can come up with.
Well,
and
sometimes
what I decided
that's
was,
the case, but
I was,
not always.
I had so many tomatoes that I would just go ahead and do sun-dried tomatoes and see if I could sell them to chefs. And as that turned out, I could.
Right. So B, you also sold, you know, food that was freshly dug, like carrots and tomatoes.
Yeah, so I used to work about 5 years ago. We started the youth farm, which was actually a one-acre education and production farm actually on the grounds of a high school in central Brooklyn. And we produced quite a lot of food that we sold. And we did also some value-added products as well. And, you know, it's amazing. You can definitely make money doing value-added products. But often, you know, when you're working on a really small scale, like the way that a lot of farms in New York City and other urban centers are, you know, you're not always actually producing the quantity to make a profit off of the value-added profit
because
you don't quite have the economy of scale sometimes.
Right.
And then, of course, the other question is about labor costs. And you know, I spend a lot of time in what I do talking about the labor costs associated with farming. So in addition to co-managing the youth farm with Molly Culver, I still do teach for Farm School NYC, which is a 2-year certificate program in urban agriculture, and I teach the small farm planning course. And we spend a lot of time talking to people about really projecting your labor and how much it's going to cost.
Yeah, this whole profit and loss, you know, math.
Yeah.
Trying to figure it out.
And so, unfortunately, you know, I think a lot of small producers will start going into a value-added market and not really accurately project how much labor they put into it.
Oh.
And now, of course, that depends on if you're trying to pay yourself for your time.
Right.
Right.
And, you know, if you're doing it as a hobby, it's one thing. Right. But in New York City, usually, you know, a lot of urban farming is about, you know, providing entrepreneurship activities and opportunities to people that otherwise wouldn't have those opportunities, especially mm-hmm. a lot of the youth in New York
yeah.
City we work
Where
with.
Where would you ever go to work on a farm in the New York City otherwise?
Yeah, or employment. Right. There's a huge problem with employment for youth. So it's, you know, it's often a great activity to mm-hmm. actually pay youth to produce a value-added product.
That is such
I agree with that. That's an excellent way to teach youngsters a trade or a craft or something like that, that you never know when you're going to be able to use it or that they might move away from the city, you know. And then they'd have the knowledge to go ahead and have a 1 or 2 acre micro farm based on what they learned in the inner city.
So there's, there's so many pros, I guess, of micro farming, whether you're making a profit or not. But I thought it was really interesting to find out, flipping through this book, there's so many niches, too, that you could get into farming ingredients that you don't find elsewhere. So one example I thought was a great example was like ginseng or ginger. Dave, you mentioned people were getting into, tilapia farming, mushroom farming, things that I don't think of when I think about farming because I think of tomatoes. So what about these, like, I guess, specialty items? Is that a good route if you're just starting out and you're maybe not the jack of all trades when it comes to agriculture?
Well, I like to focus on
chili peppers?
Smaller crops that have a higher value, I guess what you'd say.
Right.
I'm speaking of just a couple of examples. Super hot chilies, which I did
mm-hmm.
when people were paying for one pod. Of course, they wanted the seeds, but for one ripe pod, they were paying a dollar or two. And it doesn't take too many pods to start making a little bit of a profit from the plants that you can actually grow in containers. So, you know, the size, you could have couple of hundred square feet and literally raise a couple of hundred plants, given 1 square foot, at least, you know, the pot average anyway.
Wow.
And then there's a lot of people who grow things under lights. I'm speaking of medical marijuana in this particular case, if it's legal, and you obey all the rules and so forth like that of the particular state you live in, that can be highly
I'm sure that will
well.
Be lucrative.
Yeah, because that's a crop that is extremely valuable in small quantities.
Sure.
I'm not making any moral judgments here, but with nearly half the states in the union having some form of marijuana legalized, I don't think it's something we have to whisper about anymore. It's legal.
Yeah,
and
as long as
it's legal and you can grow it properly, fine. And of course, not everybody does, but the changes here out west are just amazing in terms of medical marijuana. It's just astounding. I mean, here's Colorado collecting $40+ million in taxes. A lot of states would love to have that kind of income.
Wow.
So I think what we're going to see is people paying more attention to the economics
right.
of the whole situation, and other things that you can grow, like super hot chilies. And then when you take something like, if you're growing tomatoes and you try to grow something that the chefs want to buy,
right.
a particular variety, some kind of thing that'll get their attention, something that, like the chef I was growing for, he would make sauces out of the different colored tomatoes that I would bring up to him, purple tomatoes and yellow tomatoes, orange tomatoes and all that. They were sun-dried, and then he would make sauces that he would use in all the different kinds of things, and people would say, "What's this purple sauce?" "Oh, that's from purple tomatoes." And he'd get a lot of play on the menus and all that kind of stuff because he'd actually put the source on the menu, grown by so-and-so, so-and-so. So that gives
awesome.
The farmers a really warm and fuzzy feeling that they're not just doing this as a chore or even for a little bit of money, but they're actually getting some stardom here.
Right.
As a provider for a top-notch restaurant, that's saying something.
Definitely. So, B, did you find yourself gravitating towards certain more profitable crops over time?
Well, I think that's a really important question, especially mm-hmm. when you're talking about micro farming, especially in the context of urban agriculture, of mm-hmm. what crops you're going to grow. And I think it really gets to the question of, are you growing things that have a higher profit versus growing things for the community and uh-huh. who you're actually growing for? And I think that that is something that is really important, and not to downplay the need to actually be financially viable. But I do feel like, you know, especially in urban agriculture, it's important to do both. It's important to be economically viable and also to have very strong values in your business and in your farm, to think about what you're growing and who you're growing it for and what right. economy that's setting up. So I think in New York City, there's a lot of amazing farms that are growing very highly profitable items such as microgreens, salad mixes, specialty tomatoes,
herbs,
things like that for high-end chefs, and that allows those organizations to also grow, you know, some food
right.
for their community.
Carrots.
Exactly. And, you know, to kind of offset both. But I don't think we, in urban agriculture, we're really trying to push the model of just growing high-end crops for
right.
high-end restaurants, because that's not really serving a larger social justice agenda.
Oh, yeah, and especially when you're teaching the kids, that totally makes perfect sense.
Yeah, or for adults. I just, you know, it's yeah. not the economy that we're trying to have in mm-hmm. New York City. But to, you know, to think about being financially viable, it is really important to think about those niche crops and which crops you do have a higher profit margin.
Yeah.
So
it's great
to have a mixture of both.
Yeah. Is it more fun for you to have a whole spectrum of different plants? Because, you know, looking at a small garden, seeing like all kinds of stuff growing in the same patch, I bet that's kind of really, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a great feeling.
Yeah, I don't know anyone, you know, in the city specifically that's doing that other mm-hmm. than, you know, maybe looking at the rooftop hydroponic farms.
Yeah, Gotham Greens or something.
Yeah, that are really doing like the specialty herbs and things like that. But
yeah.
But I mean, I don't know, an amazing micro farm I think of is Oko Farms right here in Bushwick. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they do an amazing array of vegetables as well as fish.
Whoa.
So, yeah, it's an amazing aquaponics farms, and they teach aquaponics, and they work with the local schools. They have that niche market.
And that works.
And
together.
It works.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's that combination
Whoa.
Of things that I think, you know, I mean, the hot phrase of a triple bottom line business, but...
A triple threat.
Yeah.
That's also...
But it's so much fun for
maybe.
A farmer, too, right?
Yeah.
Like, I like in the book that it was saying, you know, you need to have sustainability for the farmer too, and
yeah.
what they're doing, and
yeah, and that, you know, that kind of audience reaction when people see that purple tomato sauce, as well as when they see this crazy integrated farm with fish and something. Like, I just think, yeah, those wow factors are really eye-catching and hopefully inspiring for a lot of new folks getting into farming. I'm going to cut to a quick little musical interlude, and we'll be right back. You are listening to Quick by Dreams, and this is Eat Your Words on heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, hey, we're listening to Eat Your Words, and we're talking with Dave DeWitt, author of Microfarming for Profit and many other books. and B. Ayer, farmer extraordinaire. Okay, so let's get into the nitty-gritty for just a second, because I'm maybe seriously thinking about doing, you know, some agriculture here. Dave, you mentioned that you think that for a micro farm, the most cost-efficient way to kind of arrange your plot is in raised beds, or basically containers.
That just works for me, because I'm going to be irrigating with drip hoses, and I can better contain everything and in a raised kind of bed situation. It works for me best, but it might not work for everybody best. For example, I like it because I know that we don't get much rainfall here, so it works perfectly. It's so well drained, but it might not work in some other places as well as it does here. In other words, if you got 80 inches of rain instead of 8 inches of rain, all the soil might wash out of your raised beds.
Yeah,
and it might not work at all. But for me, it's just one of a number of different beds I can use. I also used what I called modified irrigated beds, which weren't raised, but they had like
sub-irrigation?
Little furrows in the garden, and I could just put the hose in one section of the garden, and it would water the whole thing in about a half an hour, and then I could remove the hose. So it was that was also efficient, but it wasn't raised or anything like that. It was just soil with some organic fertilizer and manure rototilled into it, and then I would form the beds with a shovel, and that worked pretty well for me too. But I still prefer the raised beds. I like that better.
Is there also a concern about, like, controlling the quality of the soil when you're dealing with a small contained system, like a container or a raised bed?
You have to. In container gardening, the problem is root cramping. And so you have to have a very loose kind of soil. I use perlite, for example, as a soil separator. And theoretically, the foliage mass above the ground is theoretically supposed to be equal to the root system below it in terms of volume. That's what happens with trees. That's what happens with most plants. But in containers, of course, you're restricting the roots. And so your foliage won't get as big as it does if the plant is just directly planted into the ground, and then you have to use water-soluble fertilizers. Let's not even get into organic versus inorganic at this point, because I don't think the plant knows the difference between nitrogen, no matter how it's applied, but that's just the way I feel. I prefer to use organic techniques, but a lot of times you can't in certain circumstances. Like, for example, if you have people growing inorganically next to you, driving all the insects into your field, that's a big problem to keep your own garden organic when there's drift. But in containers, I know I'm going to be using a water-soluble fertilizer, and then, with the cramped roots and so forth, they can dry out very, very quickly.
Right, you can keep it all controlled.
Right.
Yeah. So I know a lot of people are confused, especially in New York City. It's like, is my soil, in the in-ground soil, is that good quality? Should I do the raised beds? Is that just going to give me, be able to sleep better and not worry about it? B, you guys had an in-ground lot.
At the youth farm where I used to work, we actually stumbled upon amazing soil. Yeah, but you know what? I think no matter where you're farming or gardening, anywhere, if you're in the city or if you're in rural areas, the first thing you want to do is do a complete soil test. Because
Absolutely.
You're going to find out both the nutrients in the soil and any contamination.
Yeah, and what Dave was saying about, like, traveling contaminants from neighbors, plots, from who knows what. I'm sure there's a lot of who knows what in the city, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of contamination in the city. There's also a lot of contamination in rural areas, especially, if you are farming somewhere that used to be farmed conventionally or was an orchard or something like that.
Or there's fracking or something
like that. it's not just a city concern, but it's definitely a huge concern in the city. And, luckily in most cities in the United States right now, there's some organizations that will help you do soil testing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you got to send your soil test to a lab. Here we have Cornell, we have Brooklyn College locally, and then you can, you know, decide what to do. Very often it's covering up that existing toxic soil in New York City and bringing other soil in or creating soil on site. But sometimes you stumble upon gold and you find beautiful soil, even in New York City.
Well, I live in the South Valley of Albuquerque, which is semi-rural, and I found in my backyard tires, glass, evidence of many, many garbage dumps, and I had to clean all that up. And I'm not even in the inner city or anything like that. So I was shocked, but it turns out that people, before there was regular garbage pickup, people would burn the garbage in the backyard. That's what they did. And that goes back maybe 40, 50, 100 years. I'm not sure.
Wow.
But, yeah, you have to have your soil tested, and you have to take all the contaminants that you see out of the soil. And I'm sure there's going to be even more broken glass in the inner city, but I found a lot of it. So just saying.
Really funny. Yeah, so I might be leaning towards the container or the raised bed, but what about, we're running a little bit out of time, but, you know, what is the biggest challenge, you think, in your experiences going, you know, trying to make a profit specifically?
I think it's getting kicked in the butt by nature is one of the biggest problems. I mean, we have a problem with curly top, which is a viral disease that affects peppers and tomatoes especially. And often,
all those diseases sound so scary.
Of my
like
tomato
rot.
Crop is wiped out, and I have to replant.
Okay, so it's Mother Nature.
Mother Nature.
What do you got, B?
I mean, I think Mother Nature is pretty important, and you know, knowing actually horticulture well or what you're doing. But, you know, also just the market is sometimes difficult. You know, the price of food often is so low, and people really don't value.
You mean the price of imported GMO food? It's really low.
The price of the food that doesn't have a lot of nutrients that's sold in our neighborhoods. And so I think, you know, kind of changing the larger food system is the biggest problem. I feel like, you know, we've got a lot of amazing farmers and great educational programs and, you know, if you're in rural areas, great, you know, the organic extension specialists are amazing, but changing the food system is a lot harder, but we're trying.
All right, food system, Mother Nature. what, beyond the profit, to you, Dave, is the best aspect of doing your microfarming?
Oh, I think eating the perfect ripe tomato with a little oil and vinegar and using that as lunch, making a chili sauce that just tastes wonderful. It's that kind of appreciation of the food you're growing, and you say, boy, that was a good one.
That was a really good one. Yeah, that sounds so perfect. I can't wait for it to get warmer here. Bea, what do you think?
I mean, everything, you know, I love what I do, and I would agree with Dave. I have a line of hot sauces and salsas called Farmer Bees, and you know, in the winter time, sitting around with friends and having them have hot sauce is a really, you know, personally an amazing experience, and I think, you know, even more, you know, wonderful than that is knowing that, you know, the food justice movement and urban farming in New York City is making a difference in people's lives and giving opportunities to people and, you know, fighting against the corporate food system and even things like gentrification. You know,
in this bottle of chili sauce. I love it. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think, you know, the urban farms in New York City are, you know, they are places of community organizing and trying to steer our city to where we want it to be. And I mean, what better than that plus fresh tomatoes?
Absolutely. All right, guys. Thank you so much for sharing your personal journeys. And definitely check out Microfarming for Profit, From Garden to Glory. This is such a great, not only a how-to and all these steps and all these considerations, but a lot of cool personal profiles of farmers. I really enjoyed it. So thanks so much, Dave.
Oh, good talking to you.
All right, guys. See you next week on Eat Your Words.
The theme song for Eat Your Words is Lovin' Like This by the California
like
Honey Drops.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.